Recording in progress.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guests today are. Oh, Ali, you're muted.
We better start again.
My name is Allie Gray, and I'm at the University of Toronto, Canada.
And I'm Helen Lenski, and I'm a retired professor from the University of Toronto, Canada.
Great to have you both here. And what I'd like to do, starting with Ali, then going to Helen, is to ask each of you what's currently dynamizing, preoccupying, worrying, interesting you.
Ali, you're starting.
Oh, you'd like me to go first, Helen?
Yes, please.
Okay. Dynamizing, interesting. Right now I'm writing my dissertation, and it's amazing. All I have to do is sit down and write, which sounds like a very easy thing to do, unless you've written a dissertation or a book, or I guess it really is. I don't know if this is a word, but extrapolatable to sort of other things, maybe running a marathon too. I don't know, but it's amazing how my brain tries to get out of it. All of a sudden I'll be cleaning, or like on an errand, and I'll be like, this is the time I'm supposed to be writing my dissertation. Anyway, today was a good day. It's a very important topic that I'm writing about, young people and identity. And autonomy and how they navigate that with parents who have a sometimes contrasting, sometimes aligned sense of like what identity means relationally, individually, in terms of respectability. So I couldn't imagine being ha anywhere happier in my life than I am now. I hope I just love waking up and I love what I'm doing, and it's just such a pleasure. So yeah, and it's hard, and it's I my brain is sneaky. So it was a good day in terms of writing. I'm glad to be here. Thanks, Toby.
Yeah, I know the feeling of when cleaning the house looks more attractive than sitting down and writing. You know that maybe you've been writing too much or something is amiss, because I hate cleaning the house, but I love writing. And yet there are some times when that looks like, oh, let's clean the bath or something. No. Anyway, I remember years ago reading something by well-known author who said her happiest time was after breakfast, going to her, in those days, typewriter and starting to write. And I agree with that feeling most of the time. And I'm currently writing, and I've set myself a slower pace than usual, partly because I'm feeling older than I used to be, because I am, and partly because I have the leisure of doing it for until I set a deadline, which might be January 1 next year. So I'm not trying to do the sort of marathon of writing every day, which has been my former pattern. And also, I'm going over a huge field, basically, or fields, plural. And that is because the working title of the book is The Quest for Justice in Sport. So, and I'm particularly looking at how binaries define sport in so many ways. And I'm trying not to sort of stretch the data to fit the binary model, but 90% of the time, the binaries are just sitting there staring at you, waiting to be uncovered and analyzed. And that's what I'm doing, with binaries like amateur, professional, male, female, global north, global south. There's a doping and clean sport, clean in quotes. So there's always something. Like, I do a bit of compulsive, or obsessive looking on Twitter every day, and I follow people who follow these trends, and particularly trans activists and the debates about that, which are very relevant to sport. Not that they really are integral to sport, it's just that anti-trans activists have latched onto sport as being a vehicle for their vitriol, basically. So I follow that in terms of what's animating me. That's one of the things of, getting outraged at the stuff I see on social media. I don't follow the TERFs, but I follow the activists who then retweet what Rowling is saying, or the latest in trans exclusionary laws in the US, that kind of thing. But so it's a huge, huge field, and picking on these themes around binaries that I'm particularly interested in and outraged about, basically. And it always, when I write, it tends to be motivated by outrage at injustices. So that's what's motivating me right now.
You're muted, Toby.
Thanks, Ali. Sorry. You folks have done a lot of work together. I wonder if you could both share with us a little bit about the nature of that work and also the ongoing collaboration.
Yeah, Ali, why don't you start? Yeah.
Okay. So I was a master's student at U of T in the department that Helen is in, one of the departments that Helen's widely known. Her work is, it today I think is like, would, like, if Helen were today to write, it would be no big deal, you know. I think a lot, like, and there's so much respect for her work, but when she was writing in the, what, 80s and 90s, like, to say a path breaker, to say anyway. So I, what I'm trying to convey is my, what do they say? Fangirling. I was totally fangirling Helen. And one of the professors on my master's committee said, she swims in the pool at the athletic center, just ask her for a coffee. So we had a coffee, and I, when I'm nervous, I talk a lot. and I think I was just like blabbing, trying to be charming, blabbing. Anyway, we had a really nice meeting. Helen was very patient. And then maybe a year or so later during COVID, when I'd said to Helen, if you ever wanted to do a book or something, I can't completely remember. I sort of really wanted to continue the relationship and also advance my own sort of career in ways that Helen was really experienced at and well-versed at. So I suggested, I can't remember how the idea started. I think Helen suggested it, but then all of a sudden, you know, I'm a junior graduate student and we're working on this book, editing this book that became two books, and gave me a lot of experience in terms of like using my own voice as an author. I remember I'd give feedback on the chapters, saying, you know, I think maybe this, and Helen would say, no, take out the I think, just like say it. And over time and repetition, I really started to like trust the feedback that I had to offer, and really my voice. And so today, our collaboration, I don't even think I've told Helen about my plans for our my next plans for our collaboration. Should I tell you now? Should we do the big reveal on?
Yes, I'm bracing.
Are you nervous? You don't have to respond yet, though. Okay, this is, I haven't told Helen about this, which more speaks to my disorganization than any sort of intentional surprise. But I have been working with Simon Darnell at University of Toronto's Center for Sport Policy Studies. Anyway, the name of the department isn't important. I'm sure it is for some involved. We'll leave that aside. But basically, we want to have first a podcast with Helen, not to take away from your podcast, Toby, but basically like looking at the ways that Helen's work continues to impact the field beyond just like feminist and sport feminist work, and like how the impact is enormous today. And then we do a podcast and then do a Q&A so people can come with their questions and just have a discussion. And the last thing I'll say, one of the really fun things about working with Helen is how easy it is to prepare for stuff like this when we're just bouncing ideas off of each other, like just continuing to. And I learn something from Helen every time I talk with her, whether it's about like listening or, giving more in terms of the benefit of the doubt to whoever I'm speaking to, or not giving the benefit of the doubt, Anyway, so it's a very rewarding mentorship relationship for me.
And a rewarding friendship for me too. And you did mention the talk and the Q&A and so on a while back, and it sounds fun. I'd like to do that. So I remember the coffee in the Athletic Center coffee shop with Ali way back, and I had just started editing the Emeralds book series on gender and sport, and I was recruiting new authors, and somehow I knew that Ali had completed a master's on, I didn't know the details, but I knew it was relevant to a book on gender and sport. And I asked, was she interested in converting that into a book? And then, as time went on, I didn't hear back. And then you replied saying that quite wisely you had submitted journal articles, which in the cutthroat academic context, journal articles count more than a book, go figure. But so you got journal articles out of your master's thesis, and then there wasn't a book sort of left. And as I kept following trans justice issues in the media, I sort of got to this breaking point where I remembered that you had asked, you had volunteered basically, if I was interested in a book on trans issues for my book series, then you would be interested. And so, as I got to this breaking point, I thought, this is it. We need a book. And I emailed you and said, we need a book. And you agreed. And we had back and forth by email. We had a nice face-to-face meeting in a nearby park. You rode on your bicycle, and we sat on the grass and talked, socially distanced at the beginning of COVID. And then we sent out the call for chapters, and we got such a big response that we organized them into two books, and one focuses on the problems, basically, and the challenges, and the other faces on the solutions and the resistance, including Ali's great chapter on boxing as resistance, and two chapters on boxing, actually, one from another boxer, a trans man. And the second book is particularly moving, I think, because we have first-person accounts of trans people and non-binary people's experiences in sport, the challenges they've faced, and the resistance that they've very courageously mounted. And our contributors, or people who've written about trans people, the geographic context ranges from South America to Canada and the US and UK, and I think so. It's quite a broad field geographically, and every level of sport, from recreational to high performance. And as things unfold, well, one, we got a book, a review, a so-called review that was a hatchet job that I could not read after about the first 100 words. I just closed the screen at that point because it was not a scholarly review. It was simply these trans exclusionary activists, or anti-trans activists, who happened to be university professors in the UK and Europe, just co-authored a horrible review, and one of our contributors said, why don't we challenge this in the pages of the same publication? And I said, that's life's too short. That was my answer to that, that it would be futile. They have their views not based on any rational arguments, really. Certainly in the scientific literature, there's a range of positions, but none that justify fully the trans-exclusionary position, and according to my reading. So that's where we are now. I was looking up when I started writing about trans issues and also the overlapping issues of intersex athletes, most notably starting with Caster Semenya. And I did start writing about that, or touched on trans issues in 2014 in my book, Gender Politics in the Olympic Games. But I pursued it more in the book on the Court of Arbitration for Sport in 2018, and then in the Olympic Games book in 2020, and now the two anthologies. And Ali and I co-authored the intro and the conclusion to both. So I've caught up with Ali in terms of the literature on trans issues, I think, and we can certainly move forward with more interesting and exciting things.
I wonder if I could ask you, Ali, perhaps to talk about boxing in this context, because it sounds from what Helen was saying that that was a particularly dynamic and an interesting chapter. I don't know whether it forms part of your dissertation or not, but maybe you could share some of the questions that you raised there with us.
Yeah. To answer your question, it's not going to be a chapter in my dissertation, but it is a chapter that I teach with when I teach, you know, a university class. Basically, in the chapter, it talks about how I started boxing, how boxing, basically, I used my experience boxing as a frame to sort of analyze a number of social patterns, social norms around gender and sport. And what's been really cool of having students read it is, I think oftentimes in universities and academic settings, there's this sort of like elitism around knowledge, right? What counts as knowledge? You know, that's like a really important question. And one of the senses I get is that when university students come in and they read, and this is in the humanities and social sciences, you know, of which many of those students are taking hard, like economics, math, disciplines that rely on sort of a, we might call it a positivist model of knowledge, by which I mean, you know, if the hypothesis is X, this will be the outcome, right? And that way of, anyway, I'm writing about this in my dissertation, so warning, I may go down a rabbit hole here. Toby, like, bring me back. I'm like all rabbit holes these days. Not all. What I'm trying to say is, often we think, okay, what counts as knowledge? It's something that has a survey or is produced by a scientist or is like, you know, distinguishes between right and wrong. And I'm really not interested in those questions. You know, I'm interested in what the chapter was such a great teaching tool and remains such a great teaching tool is it reminds us that like our stories are data. We're all researchers. Our experiences are data. They're giving us information. And like, I can think of 20 moments today, just like me and in the world where I was, that actually, if I think about them, tell me about how the world works. The social norms we have around gender. And, you know, I get, people think I'm all kinds of gender. I never know what Well, that's not true. I don't never. I often don't know what gender people have interpreted me as until I get a cue. Just moving through the world, right? I'm very androgynous. I dress that way. So, I think the to wrap this up, I think the sustaining gift that I get from that book with Helen, from that chapter, is like a teaching tool. And it's so cool to be in a class and read your professor's work. I mean, I guess as long as it's not super boring, right? Anyway, and it's like it was a chapter where I got to experiment with my voice as a as an academic, as an author, because academia, often it feels like if you're not writing a certain way, you are not good enough, or gonna be canceled or whatever. Like and I just that was the first time that I wrote without I'm sort of clenching my fists right now to show what writing in academia has really been for me. And it was the first time I sort of let myself let my hands go and relax and had fun with it. And so today when I'm writing my dissertation and it comes with joy, I really see that as a gift that Helen's given me, because Helen's an amazing writer. She like you can tell she's having fun writing. You can tell she shows off, and you can and it's compelling, So I've always wanted to write not exactly like that, because it's my own way, but with that sort of fluency or grace, I guess. I don't know what to call it, but that was sort of the first time that I felt like I could experiment. But it was hard. I'd been trying to write software for a long time, so it's a difficult skill. Anyway, yeah, that's what jumps to mind.
Yeah, well, you've succeeded, absolutely.
And
And it,
I can talk about the punches and all that if that's what you're going for, Toby, but I don't think so. Oh, sorry, I cut you off, Helen.
I wanted to follow up with what you said about knowledge, because I just, perhaps late in my career, came across this concept. I mean, I've known the concept, but I haven't seen it called epistemic justice, and I hadn't seen it called epistemic violence either. So there are two different concepts that showed up in literature I've been reading in the last week. One by a trans author, can't remember the exact references, so I won't try, but I can give them to you, Ali, if you're interested. But basically, a concept that feminists way back, perhaps with the early women's health movements in the 60s, 70s, that the argument, quite rightly, was that women should be involved in decisions that affect women's health, a basic sort of democratic value in a sense. And oh, look at that cat. Toby's cat. Sorry, I'm a cat person, so I couldn't help saying that. And I probably lost my train of thought. So in the case of, for example, trans people, men and women, and that's what I was talking about at that particular time, what I was writing about. And there's a very interesting article co-authored by about 20 or so trans scientists or partners or family of trans scientists who are trans allies. And they have a discussion of epistemic justice, and they point out that they are quite often disqualified from decisions that affect trans health if they are health researchers, health scientists, because they're seen as being biased because they and working out of self-interest. Well, yeah, what's wrong with working out of self-interest? If obviously trans people or women or LGBTQ people in general or black people or people of color or Asian people, if there's a policy that affects their health and they are not voices at the table having an equal say in how these policies develop, then that is epistemic injustice and epistemic violence as it plays itself out in real life. So that's a very powerful concept, I thought, and I'm pursuing that in what I'm writing right now. And as I said, it does have its origins in women's health movements of, you know, women should be around the table and female gynecologists or female scientists or female endocrinologists. And in these early days, those female experts were excluded because, one, there were women and it was a boys' club, and two, they were seen as biased because they had a stake in it, have a stake in it. So, you know, it's so self-evident in a way, and yet I had not realized, although if I'd given much thought to it, that I know the most recent controversy, Ali, that you probably know about too, is this infamous Cass report in the UK, Hilary Cass, Dr. Hilary Cass, doing a review of literature on puberty blockers for trans youth and coming out with the finding that they're dangerous and they should be withheld until people are 25 or something absolutely appalling. And there weren't, she did not consult any trans groups. She, in fact, she and her team consulted known anti-trans groups in the UK and in Florida, of all places. So for that to be called epistemic violence, it captures it completely. And as you can see, I'm outraged about that, and I'm writing on that currently.
Apologies for staggering around the room. His Majesty bit me and scratched me and drew blood. And when he does that, I need to wash and clean the wound, speaking about medical issues.
I don't know how you guys are cat people. I really don't. I really don't.
He gets jealous during podcasts sometimes. But I was listening to what you were saying, Helen, and there has been a great deal of controversy over this Cass report in the last little while. And, of course, in addition to that, to me as a fairly ignorant outsider, it seems as though a week doesn't pass without a new policy being announced by a national or international sports federation about trans participation in sports, you know, cycling, cricket, football, you name it. Swimming is a big one, obviously, and positions that seem to change quite radically over the space of a few months. It's one of the most dynamic policy issues in sports I can think of, right?
Yeah, for no really good reason, no legitimate reason. We're talking about, at the Olympic level, 10 trans athletes or something at the most, and in any given country at the elite level, 5 maybe, not even that in most sports. That would be very unusual. Like, so across, you know, 20 or 30 sports, maybe 3, something like that. And not rising to the top levels anyway because of all sorts of restrictions and barriers and so on. And the one or two who've reached Olympic level have been unsuccessful. So, yeah, and it keeps evolving. And partly the IOC, in its wisdom or lack of wisdom, had a lot of committees looking into the rules, and came up with sort of a cop-out in a sense, but in one other sense, it might have been a workable solution, except we know in hindsight it isn't. But their solution was hand over those decisions to every international federation, because there are sport-specific solutions to the inclusion question. Some sports, yes, some sports, no. And given a green light to international federations, that they just, in many cases, just implemented the most extreme exclusionary policies instead of using the opportunity to do research into alleged advantages that trans women, and mostly we're talking about trans women, alleged advantages, all the testosterone issues and so on. They didn't really do that. They just quickly came up with, okay, well, we'll just exclude them if they don't have a certain level of a low level of testosterone in their systems. So yeah, you're right that it's been a sort of weekly event that some new announcement from an international federation or a national sports organization comes up with more and more restrictions all the time. And most of them, probably almost all of them, are not justified by scientific studies of alleged advantages caused by testosterone. It varies enormously from sport to sport. In sports where there aren't any, there aren't weight categories, as somebody I follow on Twitter, she does a lot of background research. She's a trans woman in Australia who works as a taxi driver, which is very interesting because she knows more about the science than I know. She just must stay up at night or during the day studying the research and is very good at analyzing the results. And she pointed out that the average Samoan man, South Sea Islander guy, weighs in pounds, you know, something like 300 pounds or 250 pounds. Big guys. They're a big group of people in the South Sea Islands, in Samoa. The average Indian guy from India is about half that weight. And nobody says, oh, well, Samoans shouldn't be competing against Indians because it's unsafe for Indians. It's not fair. It's not a level playing field. So those sort of things, those sort of differences and those details are just ignored and you know, the agenda is to exclude trans women, and the bigger agenda on the part of the you know sort of card carrying anti-trans groups, particularly in the UK, is to get legislation to stop trans people from existing, to stop the puberty blockers, so there'll be, you know, a generation of very unhappy, suicidal young people, to even interfere with the testosterone or estrogen or whatever pharmaceuticals adults who've transitioned rely on. So they'll be miserable and perhaps suicidal. It's, you know, almost a conspiracy. And I know I read the conspiracy stuff on Twitter, so it is exaggerated, but it seems like a concerted effort to eliminate trans people because they're an aberrant behavior, they're abhorrent to religious people, and so on and so on.
Ali, I wonder if you've got something to say about those questions.
Yeah, I mean, I think Helen's focus is more sort of macro and on policy, and I think this is sort of where our work splits off a little bit, and that my engagement is really around sort of interpersonal conversations, or like on Friday I'm giving a talk at York's Women and Girls in Leadership and Sport. Sorry, York is a university in Toronto, Canada. But that's just to say that I'm involved in discussion often with women in sport, women who, some of whom are struggling with fears around the loss of women's sport. And so I really try to not think about how to convince people. Well, I do think about that too, I guess, but really I'm trying to understand you know how Helen said she read a page of that review and she closed her laptop. I'm reading and taking notes and, you know, trying to on Twitter, hey, what do you mean by this? Because I think one of the things that I've learned from doing a really different kind of activist work than Helen's doing, one that's more based in dialogue, is understanding that we need to have these conversations. we need to be able to have difficult conversations for like social order. As I understand, this is completely my opinion, but like there's a really great ethnography written by, and the word ethnography isn't important. If you don't know what that word means, I'll explain it in a second. But her name's Arlie Hochschild, and she looked at the growing split between Republicans and Democrats in the States. This is probably about a decade back. And her finding was that like groups are growing farther and farther apart and are left exposed to conversations with people who don't agree with them on fewer and fewer occasions. And that it, like, that's further polarizing things. So when I have conversations with women who are really invested in women's sports, and who are feeling threatened by the inclusion of trans women in sport, trans women and girls, right? My objective is really to like understand first before I try to share. And that's been really humbling because it's hard to hear someone who's like passionately disagrees with you. Although I wouldn't say I passionately disagree. Like I really try to focus on like, okay, what I'm hearing is like a love for women's sport. What I'm hearing is fear. And there's lots to fear about women's sport right now. You know, like women coaches are getting fired at like a disproportionately higher rate than men coaches. You know, and we can think about like what like authority and masculinity and how that is permitted in ways that like for women it's not. So, or we project mommy issues onto women's leaders and women leaders in ways that we don't. So I'm really trying to look at the issue of like how to compel, how to understand so that I can help people remember that, like, you know, when you're like six and like a little girl and you just want to play with the little girls, like, or like, you know, I don't know. I also think a lot about like young people's gender because that's the work I do is like with young people. And I think one of the gifts that the next generation is giving us, and this is also one thing that I just want to give a shout out to Helen, like she's more on top of things than like anyone I know, and she's not the youngest person I know. Do you know what I mean? Like it's just like I think the younger generation is really reminding us that like identity is like a form of reality that is separate from a binary reality, right? Like Helen said. And like gender as like a site of play and creativity and trying things out is like I'm thinking a lot about that while I'm writing and I'm, you know, dialoguing with the ideas of the young people that that I've worked with. And like, what better place is there to like, just be allowed to like experience our embodiment in sport. So I started this excerpt by saying that this is where Helen and I depart, but this is also where we align in terms of like sport. What's the purpose of sport, including competitive sport? You know, it's like, and I read about this in the chapter that we discussed. It's to like be able to tell stories about ourselves. It's about resilience. It's about, you know, humor. It's about community. It's about all these things. And like high performance athlete, I can tell you that like those high performance moments were really rewarding. And also 99.9% of people who are competing in sport, who are playing sport, aren't gonna like, that's not like part of their journey. So why are we so focused on sport just for that 0.1 percentage or whatever? I'm making these statistics up right now to make my point, but I just think, like, I don't know, it takes on this like almost militaristic. Anyway, that's a bit of a tangent, but that's also, I think, where Helen and I align in terms of, like, really, like, let's all take a pause and, like, what, there's no right answer. I'm not, you know, like, I'm willing to listen to people who don't agree with me because I think that's really important. But yeah, what is sport for?
Helen, I wonder if I could ask you about that question of being open to dialogue. If Dr. Cass rang you up today, would you take her call?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. In fact, an LGBT group interviewed her a few days after, a week after all the fallout, and she actually backpedaled on a whole lot of stuff. So, you know, I could quite, you know, hypothetically, I could have challenged her on the findings. Somebody who went through it with a fine tooth comb said that she quoted a undergraduate paper as a reference. She quoted or cited a podcast done by a right-wing known anti-trans person and so on and so on. Her sources were very disreputable, some of them. Anyway, a couple of things. When I said life's too short for me to read through this so-called book review, I read the first page. I'm 81 years old, so literally life is too short. I have other priorities, and that is to write this book, which might be my last, I don't know. So that's, you know, as a, my priorities around that. And I'm not out in the world. Certainly my being out in the worldness changed with COVID because of age and because my partner has immune suppressed system. And also I'm not actively teaching or doing many public presentations. I do a lot of media interviews on Zoom with mainstream media, or I talk to students on Zoom from, I just talked to a guy in Georgia, not Georgia, US, Georgia, Europe, about his undergraduate dissertation. And so that's the extent of me being out in the world, and probably I would not get called by, well, the Georgia guy was, you know, interested in topics to do with politicians becoming, elite athletes becoming politicians, which is apparently a trend in the in Europe in particular, not just Putin with his judo background, but a whole lot of others. So it was a very interesting topic. But as I said, sort of long story short, I'm not engaging with critics except online, pretty much. And I do that. And I do read the other side, other sides, because the people I follow who are trans activists on Twitter routinely retweet what Cass or Rowling or Helen Joyce or Julie Bindle or all the big names. I know them. They're sort of household words. So I know what the TERFs in UK in particular are saying and what they're citing and so on. And I prefer to use the pen rather than the sword, let's say. I'm not going to engage with them face to face. But as you said, if Hillary Cass phoned me, yes, we could have a conversation.
Ali, I wonder if I could ask you to go back to boxing for a moment, because I wonder if there's a connection between your desire to keep listening and keep engaging with people who are very opposed to you and the process of boxing.
Interesting. Sorry, please finish your thought.
No.
That's it. Okay. Let's riff. I love riffing. Let's riff. Okay. So boxing, what you think you need isn't always what you need, or what you, right? It's not fun getting hit in the face. My nervous system doesn't like it. And I definitely desensitize to it. but I never enjoyed it. But somehow I don't know how to describe it, but for, I think for young, precocious athletes, there can be something good from it. I learned humility in a, well, I'm learning humility, but it helped me with a few of the building blocks of learning humility, right? When I came into the sport, I was I'll just say that a dose of humility was really helpful, like a gentle so anyway, I'm not advocating that getting beat up is the antidote. I think it also was the my like my belonging on a team, having something to focus on in terms of competition that like really had a transformative impact on my life and how I understand myself today. And it was like a really key piece. So the connection I'm trying to make is that, you know, sometimes I think I know what I need in terms of having someone agree with me or which is a nice feeling, you know, to be able to persuade someone. It's kind of, it's like if it's satisfying to me. I love to debate. But I don't know. Sometimes I can see. Anyway, I apologize. My brain, like I do so much heavy lifting for my dissertation with my brain that sometimes I'm just fried by about 1 p.m. But I guess what, but if I can dig a little deeper, what I'm trying to say is I don't know how to. Sometimes I'll think I disagree with someone completely and that our sides are completely irreparable and irreconcilable. And then I look at how their maybe their solution is different. I'm not articulating this very well, but often there's more going on in common than we think, you know? For example, I got a great question at a lecture that Helen and I gave from a the Wi-Fi was totally shoddy, so I don't know if you remember this, Helen, from an athlete, a young varsity athlete on the women's, I can't remember which team. And she I felt really honored that she felt like safe enough to be or like she would take the risk in front of a bunch of people being like, well, I don't know what to do because, you know, I'm really afraid of like trans women taking over women's sport. And I just was like, okay, cool. Because that I know that takes a lot of guts. And it was if she doesn't ask that question, like, how can I give her the information that I have about that question? And when you get a question from like a young person like that, you know, who's getting information from all kinds of sources, right? Like right now there's a lot of information that is, you know, maybe not empirically produced, and some of it is, and it's still like, you know, the production of knowledge is not a straightforward process, right? Like Helen referred to earlier. But when you get a question, when I get a question like that, like it almost like forces me to stop and really think about what I'm trying to say instead of sort of assuming that we have a, that she and I have a common knowledge about what's right, what's wrong, what's real, what's imagined. I don't know. It just slowed me down. Like it was sort of like this really key moment for me where I just, sort of the wheels ground to a halt in a really productive way. So anyway, I've sort of riffed off of the connection, but sometimes what you think you need isn't what you need. And then it's really productive.
Well, I'm interested in, I keep going back to boxing and I apologize for that. I appreciate your sharing with us, by the way, the horror of having your neurons smashed. But I'm thinking about the performance of lots of high-level boxing that begins, especially perhaps on the men's side of boxing, with insults being traded and
Oh
horrible
yeah.
things being said and
Okay, you're dramatizing it a little bit. It's not, there's no terror in getting a punch. It's or and it's, you know, it's not, it's play. Where else in our, you know, well, and Helen drew to the boundaries here, but where else am I, you know, Toronto, Canada, social order, functioning highly meticulously world. Where else am I gonna face danger with consent and also protection, right? I choose to step in the ring. There's people there to protect me, to protect my opponent. It's amazing. It's like, you know, in a bubble wrapped world to take it off and, you know, get hit. And it's also, of course, you know, as you alluded to when you said the horror of getting hit in the face or the terror, it's also, yeah, of course, there's questions of consent. Like, who is able to consent? And at which point in the match are they no longer able to consent? That's another sort of question. But the in terms of I took off, I tried to emulate Muhammad Ali, who is an incredibly prolific chirper, or you know, how he would sort of incite his athlete, the his competitors to in like really smart ways. I loved that at first until I was told not to do that anymore. But it's a side of play too, right?
And there's a moment often at the end of these bouts, as I understand it, again, I'm no expert, having built up this apparent dislike of one another and then having traded blows, when people bloodied and bowed, cuddle one another, hold one another.
I mean, that's the thing about masculinity. Like, when are men allowed to like be close with each other? And I think that is the root of, we could have another conversation. I'm sure Helen has so much to input in terms of like how the lack of permission for men to like hold hands or whatever, express affection toward each other is like is a has implications in everywhere in terms of gender.
If I could just say one more thing, and I'm going back to the student who was fearful of trans women taking up a sport. While I would be respectful in my answer to her question, I would have also said, if I was a young athlete, I would lie awake at night worrying that my coach is going to abuse me, my male coach. I would lie awake at night worrying that the team funding is going to be cut by Sport Canada or the US or whatever. There are a whole lot of worries that I would have that were far more realistic worries and far more imminent threats than trans girls or women taking over my sport. And I don't think I could stay. You know, just I could not validate beyond a certain point that that was a concern, because I would have to say, just absolutely pragmatically and common sense with empirical evidence, the threats to women's sport are not trans women. The threats to women's sport are men and funding and the Olympic industry and the media exploitation or sex exploitation, just things I've been writing about since 1980. They are the big things. It's not a handful of trans girls and women who get undue, exaggerated, vitriolic publicity in the mainstream media for doing what they would love to do and cannot do.
Well said. Yeah. I have, Toby, I have a heart out at 3, unfortunately. Just so you know.
1 minute.
One minute.
Okay.
But you should keep chatting with Helen because she
No, I
is
can
so
see the clock
justly.
is about 2:49, 59. So,
well, thank you very, very much, Ali, for being here. Helen, maybe we could have 5 or 10 minutes more. Would that
sure,
be
I'd love
with
to.
you? It was great to meet you, Ali, and to learn from you, and I really appreciated it.
It was great to meet you as well, Toby, and Helen. We're due for a Diplomatico. Okay.
So, Helen, something was crossing my mind when we were speaking, and it was about elite sports events that are less binary than others. Somewhat less binary, mixed doubles in tennis, somewhat. It involves binaries but crosses them. And I'm also thinking about things like equestrianism, archery, shooting. Some elements of jockey horse racing that I think
Yachting too, I think. I think
yachting,
Olympic yachting.
yes, where at the elite international level, and obviously horse racing is not in the Olympics, but these other things are, there isn't a binary division, is there, that's as solid as you get in some sports. And no one's talking about that, the fact that the male-female distinction is not so important universally.
And on the other side of the coin, you have chess imposing rules about trans women.
This was a couple of weeks ago, I think, that we read this, right? And it's all mind-boggling, but that's got to be the craziest of the lot.
I know my trans taxi driver, as I call her, her name's Kirsty Miller, in Broken Hill, which you know of all places, a trans woman in Broken Hill driving a taxi. She and her female partner own the taxi. They bought the license for the taxi when they moved to Broken Hill and went through hell, but now they're good, apparently. She said something like, ever since I transitioned, I haven't been able to pick up the chess pieces as I'm finding the chess pieces are heavier, making a joke about
I love
it.
it. I don't know if you saw this, Helen, but just very shortly before we started recording, I read that the FBI is paying out over $100 million dollars to the survivors of NASA's sexual violence.
Oh, wow.
Literally, I think this happened in the last couple of hours. This relates very much to what you were saying about how you would reply potentially to the young woman. Respectfully, but saying, if you want to talk about threats, look at male sexual violence and male occupation of resources and domination of resources, right? But just now, I mean, no amount of money, obviously, is enough to compensate for what was done to those women.
I think there
But
was an FBI agent who did part of the cover up. So I think that was the link.
So it's, I mean, I think those arguments are incredibly important and powerful and really need to be emphasized, that let's look at what and where the real threats are, rather than generate moral panics that are not empirically based. So I really appreciated what you just said at the end there of our conversation with Ali. Before you and I conclude, I wonder whether there are other things that you want to add to what we've already said today.
Well, it's the interesting thing about belonging and how sport gives participants a sense of belonging in a team or a club. And I touched on that in the part I wrote to the intro to one of the trans books, not being personal about it, just but then with this book, because I can say what I like in any book, but in this book there's a bit more sort of my own reflections on where I've been coming from since the 1980s and so on. And I'm not an athlete, really. I've belonged to a lesbian softball team for 2 years. It's the only time I belonged to any club, and I didn't feel a sense of belonging. People were very nice to me. I was totally useless at playing softball, absolutely. There was a bit of the social side was usually fun. And I'm a sole recreational athlete. I do swimming by myself. I used to do running by myself. I kayak by myself. I'm not interested in having company for any of those things. And that I'm not an athlete in that sense. I'm this, individual soul reclusive athlete who wants to do stuff by herself. And so I can't relate really to, oh, I'm a member of a team, rah, 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 It's not, I can't relate. So I have to sort of fess up in the book that, okay, that's documented and people do that, but that's not me. So, and interesting sort of a segue from that, years ago, I guess it might have been 2018, I did a talk in Sydney at University of Technology Sydney, about my book on the Court of Arbitration for Sport. And someone in the audience who looked vaguely familiar, but I couldn't place him. It turns out he, we had both not seen each other since 2000, and it was 18 years later, and he'd had some health problems, so he looked older and different. And when I heard his voice, I sort of thought, oh yeah, that's who that is. He stood up in front of this mostly sport crowd and said, I hate sport. And then he explained, what sport has become. And he was, I think he played football or something, as Australian guys do. And, but he explained that he would not say I love sport, whereas I think Ali would say I love sport. I would say I love my individual physical activities. I don't love sport. I don't watch much sport. I only watch it for academic reasons. So, I'm an outsider, and I think that's a plus.
Yes, I think that's a really interesting comment because so, for those not involved in sports sociology, kinesiology, human movement studies, these other things, they're full of jocks and they're full of people who either loved their own participation in sport or love watching sport or love its history or want to make it more efficient and effective at a high level of achievement in inverted commas, but mostly people who are not interested in criticizing sports. And those who are high achievers but are interested in criticizing sports are remarkable, I think. There are some. I'm thinking of Don McPherson, for example, or who was, I think, in the Canadian Football League, didn't quite make it in the NFL, but was an important college player, quarterback, one of the few black quarterbacks in his era, who's dedicated his life since pro football to issues of masculinity. Or I think of our friend Jim Mackay, who was a jock and dedicated to these issues. And I mean, there are plenty of other people we could name, but they're fairly small in number compared to true believers who either were successful or weren't and wish they had been. And yet, the same with sports journalists. There's so much vicarious wannabe desire and so little serious critique, particularly of gender issues, especially gender and sexuality issues.
Dave Zirin's one of the good ones.
Oh, yes, he's great. A journalist for The Nation. Absolutely fantastic, isn't he? And he also is one of the few US writers who can transcend the United States, specifically the Anglo United States world, in order to think about sports. I agree. He is really wonderful. So that, there are beacons out there. And as Ali pointed out, you've been one of them for many of us for a long time. So it was just great to connect with you again after our previous discussion. I really enjoyed it. So thank you very, very much. And let's do it
You're
again
welcome.
soon.
Yes, okay. Thanks.